morning. First case of the morning will be United States versus James Litke. Mr. Rooney.
Thank you. Good morning, Your Honors. May it please the court, counsel. Arthur Rooney on behalf of defendant appellant James Litke. This case involves the warrantless search of Mr. Litke's bedroom by Wisconsin parole agents and local law enforcement authorities and the subsequent seizure of several incriminating items contained in that bedroom. Before trial, Mr. Litke filed a motion to suppress that evidence, arguing that the search and seizure violated his Fourth Amendment rights. After conducting an evidentiary hearing, the district court denied the motion, and the case proceeded to trial, where Mr. Litke was ultimately convicted and sentenced. The sole issue on appeal is whether the district court erred in denying that Litke's motion to suppress. In denying that motion, the district court relied upon three separate grounds, and my hope here today is to address each of those grounds in turn. First, the district court found that Mr. Litke was on parole on January 23, 2003, the time of the search in this case, and therefore could lawfully be subjected to a parole search. It is undisputed that Mr. Litke was released from prison and paroled to the Wisconsin Department of Corrections in late August 2002, and that his term of supervision was set to expire on November 4th, 2002.
So he was released in error.
He was not released in error. He was released. He was appropriately released in late August of 2002, and his term of supervision. So he was on parole from late August until November 4th, 2002. And the issue is whether his parole was somehow tolled or extended until January 23rd, 2003.
He wasn't due to be released until what date?
He was released.
I didn't ask what day he was released. What was his correct date to be released?
Your Honor. His correct release date from prison was in August of 2002, and he was on parole until November 4th, 2002, and the government doesn't dispute that. The issue is whether the parole was somehow extended until January of 2003 when the search was conducted in this case. To answer this question, we look to Wisconsin's tolling statute, which allows the Department of Corrections to toll a parolee's sentence if the department determines that the parolee was in violation of his or her terms of his or her supervision.
Now, of course, we don't have to and shouldn't reach the question of whether or not he was still on parole if we find that Hillstead's consent was proper.
That's correct, Your Honor. And the district court had three separate grounds for its decision here, and the first being that he was on parole. Do you want me to address the issue of the consent?
Well, I would like to know why you believe that Hillstead's consent didn't cover the bedroom, given that he kept some of his own things there, and every single time he had to use the bathroom, he had to walk through that bedroom.
That's correct, but there's two reasons the district court erred here. First, and most importantly, the government waived this argument. The government did not raise this argument before the magistrate judge and expressly waive the argument at the evidentiary hearing.
Yes, but the district judge pursued it.
The district judge, Hillestad was questioned by Mr. Litke on the voluntariness of his consent, and then the district judge asked the government if it had any questions. The government replied no. Then the district judge went into the questioning regarding the consent issue and then asked the government again, do you have any questions? The government replied no. And Mr. Litke was representing himself here pro se, and even though the questions might have gone to the consent issue, he was never informed that the government was pursuing this theory or that the district court was pursuing this theory. And in fact, the government expressly waived it. And as you can see from the record, the record was not developed on this issue, and it's unclear. In fact, it's unclear where what Hillestad's access to this room was and where he kept his possessions. If the record indicates that Hillestad stated the room was Lukey's, he more or less took it over, and it's constantly referred to as Lukey's bedroom. For all we know, Hillestad slept on the sofa in the living room, had his possessions out there. It's unclear exactly what his access to the bedroom and to those and to the containers that were found, where the incriminating evidence was found inside that bedroom.
I know. I agree with everything that you've said, but there's a further step. The court, on its own motion, followed up and explicitly concluded that even though the government had not represented that it was going to argue that the consent extended throughout the apartment, that the evidence was such that consent given by Mr. Hillestad did extend through the apartment. So
that was part of the district court's conclusion, but it was after the questioning of...
I think that's a problem. But go ahead.
Okay,
go ahead.
Well, I mean, it's a pro se defendant, and the government states they're not raising this issue. Therefore, Hillestad never questioned him on this. The government never questioned him on it. And at the very end, the district court asks some questions and then rules. And if you look at the record, the record's not developed on this issue. But and next, even
what's
the evidence...
What's different about this case from United States versus Aikido?
Here there's evidence that, well, one, I don't think the record's adequately developed on the issue, and two, all we have here is evidence that Hillestad could access the bathroom. We don't have any evidence indicating what exactly Lukey allowed him to do.
But in Aikido, we said that the roommate's periodic cleaning of the room and storage of clothing was enough to authorize a consent to search. We've got, you know, Lutke with all of his stuff in there.
Well, here, even if you conclude that Hillestad could go into the bedroom, we still have the issue of the containers. If the record indicates that the evidence was found inside a duffel bag, in a file cabinet drawer, in a box, the record doesn't indicate whether those items were closed or open. The record also doesn't indicate what Hillestad's access was to those containers. And
are you arguing that Lutke had exclusive control over the bedroom?
I would argue that he had exclusive control other than Hillestad's limited access to the bathroom, to get to the bathroom.
Who was the lessee of the apartment?
Hillestad was the lessee, but...
And how did he lose... How did he lose
rents
right for the entire apartment? Anything in writing?
There was no sublease or anything of that nature. He rented for $180 bedroom to Hillestad.
And he told the other man that he could move in with him.
Yes, that is correct.
Period. But he didn't give up his rights to any part of the apartment in writing, did he?
No, but the common consent doesn't rest on the law of property. It's the issue is whether he had joint access or control over the bedroom and those containers for most purposes. All we have here is that he had joint access or control for the limited purpose of accessing the bathroom. And once again, I don't think the record is adequately developed.
Where do you get this limited purpose from? Is that in writing?
It's not in writing. It's all the facts show. The facts only indicate that he could get to the restroom.
The facts that you want to tell us about.
Well, I didn't find any facts that indicated otherwise. So,
right.
I think that's the problem, is where the record wasn't developed. And it's in the record, it is not clear what rights Hillestad had over the bedroom.
Okay, do you want to reserve your time? You got a minute or so left. Thanks. Moreno Taxman.
Good morning, counsel. May it please the court. My name is Corrine Moreno Taxman. I'm an assistant U.S. attorney, and I was the trial attorney as well. And I would like to address some of the points that were raised by counsel. First of all, the first point that he raised was that consent was never an issue that was raised by the United States. And I would refer the court to the July 24th, 2003 transcript, in which prior to the hearing regarding what the issues were going to be, I said, Judge, I said, quote, the very first theory is going to be, Your Honor, there was consent to search. That is how we started the hearings, and then we had the hearings over 2 days. So I think that for the impression that's been given here that we waived that consent issue, we did not waive the consent issue, and in fact proceeded on it, put into evidence various exhibits, which defense counsel appellant has put on, attached to his brief, which shows a written consent of the place, as well as the diagrams of the apartment, the small apartment that's really a one-room apartment. And those would be exhibits. In the back of the brief, there is exhibit number one. The first exhibit that was entered is the exhibit that is Jason Hillstead's written consent, and that was entered by me as on behalf of the United States of America. The next exhibit, which is exhibit two, is the diagram of the room, the little apartment that shows how this room is really a hallway to the bathroom. Also, that Mr. Hillstead testified not only did he use it for the bathroom, but that he also stored some of his possessions there. So I think I did not waive consent. Consent was clearly articulated. In addition, when Mr. Ludke brought in Mr. Hillstead to testify, the record was further developed on that.
What was the sort of the equivocating statement that I guess you said?
The equivocating statement, Judge, was earlier before the hearings had started, I had said that I was not going to be relying on consent because I believe that there was sufficient between the probable cause from the parole search as well as the warrant. And to be honest, I really didn't know if Mr. Hillstead would show up or not. And so I was not going to put my whole case on Mr. Hillstead, who had been a homeless person and had been hard to find. So I didn't want to offer something to the court that I wasn't sure I could present. It ended up that...
He was homeless?
Yes, he was. After he was in that apartment, he had been homeless after that.
He was renting the apartment?
For a short period of time.
I see.
Right.
He didn't own it?
No, he did not own that apartment.
But he had whatever he was renting when Ludke came in and stayed with him.
Right, and Ludke had just come, I think it was 7 or 8 days before. So it's not as if Ludke had been there for a long period of time and had made rules or put a lock on the door. They were still...
Okay. You weren't sure he was going to show up. So that's
at trial.
I see.
At trial, Judge. It was one of those realities which Mr. Hillstead, as well as several of the witnesses in this case, were all transient. And so I didn't want to present to the court and rely on Mr. Hillstead's testimony until I was sure I had it. And so that's why that happened. But once he was produced, I totally relied on him, as did the court. In addition, Your Honor, I would like to talk about one of the issues made by the defense, that he was not released in error. I dispute that. On the transcript, on the hearing of July 24th at page 86, Ms. Davis specifically testifies that the jail did release him unexpectedly, not the date that they had told her he would be released. And
so the release was in error.
Yes, that was my understanding.
That's what I tried to get.
That is my understanding.
He didn't agree.
And that's why she then went and did the apprehension request. Also, the argument that the defendant was acting pro se. This, as I'm sure the court can see through these transcripts, this man was very knowledgeable of many rules and laws and clearly knew the state probation code better than I did.
You're talking about the convict now.
Yes, Mr. Ludke.
Right.
He was well-versed. He was clearly able to represent himself. He had standby counsel throughout the whole trial and used it quite well, I think. So I would dispute that the fact that he was pro se should somehow make it that this was not an appropriate search. Finally, I just want to say one thing. Really, if we look at this record, this is the time where law enforcement has done everything right. You start off with probation and parole. They get a tip from someone who they know. They act on it, but they don't act on it recklessly. They call in the police. The police come in just to secure the premises and to make sure Mr. Luedtke is safe. They then leave. It's only when the parole officer calls them back and says, we found some guns, we found some money, that they then decide they should take some action. But what's the action that they take? They go to a judge, and they get a warrant. And they lay this all out for the judge and then come back and execute that warrant. If we're talking about interagency cooperation, if we're talking about review by a magistrate, all of those things happened exactly as I think all of us would hope, and really an exemplary way. So I hope the court considers that, too, because really the claim that this was an invalid search really would contradict the exemplary conduct that these officers and courts took part in this case.
Well, Hillstead also, in his initial contact, didn't he say there were guns and money?
Yes, guns and money, over $2,000, and that he was packing to leave.
Some of it was the marked money.
It ended up being marked money. That is correct. And the other thing that Hillstead...
But they went there. My point is they... That was before they went in and saw any guns.
That's correct.
At least something that was reported.
Yes, not only was it reported, but then the police had Mr. Hillstead go back into the apartment before the probation officers went in to verify if the guns were still there that same day. Mr. Hillstead went in, saw the guns, came back out and said, yes, the guns are still there. So not only did he report it, but then he again went and verified it for that day. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
You have about a minute, I guess. We've got a minute left.
Thank you. I'll respond quickly to a few points the government made. First, regarding the consent argument, before the magistrate judge, the government never made the argument. At the district court, at the evidentiary hearing, in her opening statement, she said that the consent to search went into the living room, into the common areas, and then was going to argue plain view from those areas what they saw. And regarding the quote that I cited in the brief, it was not before the evidentiary hearing. It was after the opening and during the questioning of Officer Genan. The district judge went, looked at the AUSA present here and asked, is the government taking the position that the consent of Hillstead extended to the bedroom? Quote, and the AUSA responded in the negative, quote, Judge, I won't take that position. It's unclear to me, but I won't take the position that it did. The theory was never raised. The district court did ask some questions, but Mr. Luedtke, who was pro se, he had standby counsel, but the counsel was not allowed to feed him questions or ask the questions, was never put on notice of this theory, and that's why the record was inadequately developed. And regarding the release being an error, the prison let Mr. Luedtke out in early August. He didn't have a place to live, so his parole agent put him back in the prison. They let him out again. My understanding
back
is he was
in the jail.
Into the jail. My understanding is he wasn't released early. The problem was he didn't report to his parole agent when he was released because he was homeless and he didn't report his whereabouts as required by the parole regulations. But the issue is not when he was released. It's the fact is his term of supervision expired on November 4th. The search occurred 3 months later. And finally, regarding what they knew beforehand, under the independent source doctrine. Oh, I'm out of time.
You better wrap it up.
Okay. Under the independent source doctrine, the issue is whether the question is, did the earlier entry, the parole search here, affect or prompt the officer who, in fact, went and got the search warrant, Officer Genan? Mr. Luedtke asked Officer Genan, after you found out the tip, after you learned this information and talked to the parole agents, but before you went into the apartment and searched it, did you have probable cause? Specifically ask him, and he said no. And it's not whether he could have, whether he in fact had probable cause, it's whether he would have. The officer said, I didn't have probable cause.
Okay.
Thank you.
Thanks very much. I understand you were appointed counsel.
Yes, sir.
Okay. We appreciate your advocacy for your client.
Thank you.
Thanks very much. That case will take an under advisement. We'll move on to the second case.